trying to speculate in what the Omar is actually doing. If I can start with the map is totally unsatisfactory and the map is the wrong period and so on, but nevertheless, just to, it's only here to demonstrate the fact that Tobruk is down there, which I would beg you to remember. Mota is here south of Kerak, and the Wadi is here Harm. Now I'll come back to this again, this point of the Tobruk, up to Kerak area, and the Wadi is here Harm throughout this lecture. What I'd like to try and suggest is a framework in which the transitional period between the Byzantine and the Umayyad, the Islamic conquest, the Umayyad presence in this country, might be considered. It's purely speculative. I mean, those who disagree are entitled to shoot me down after the lecture and email. I'd also like to try and tie in these various suggestions into an archaeological context as far as is possible. And there's one point which I think one must bear in mind, one is arguing always with an arm tied behind one's back, insofar as in the Hejaz, I hear south, down into Saudi Arabia, western Saudi Arabia, we have no concrete archaeological material from the period of the Prophet, nor do we have any concrete archaeological material from the period of the four rightly guided caliphs, the Khalifa Rashidin, Abu Bakr, Umar ibn Khattab, Uthman ibn Affan, and Ali ibn Abi Sufyan. And this makes things rather difficult because without the knowledge of what goes on in Hejaz, what happens in southern Jordan, central Jordan, the Jordanian desert area, one will never have a complete picture, but we have to operate in the absence of material up to this point. For this early Islamic period, we've got a certain amount of material that is really rather poor. We know that Amr ibn al-As built a mosque in Fustat after he founded Fustat in Egypt. We know that the early Muslims established mosques and cities in Basra and Kufa. None of these things remain in any archaeological sense. We have remains of dams in the area of Taif, Khaybar, in Saudi Arabia, dating the period of Muawiyah, the first Umayyad caliph, 660 onwards, although he had been governor in Syria from 640. We have a certain number of inscriptions. We have a certain number of coins. But for this very early period, we really don't have anything other than literary reference and these portable objects of the nature of coins. The dams in Saudi Arabia have not been discovered. So we are really very poor for the very early Islamic period. On the other hand, it does survive a considerable amount of literary evidence dating back to the Abbasi period from the latter part of the 8th century, 9th century, primarily the 9th century AD. Referring to the life of the Prophet, the conquest of the Islamic conquest of the area in the time of the Prophet. We have the works of Al-Waqidi, Ibn Sa'd, Ibn Hisham, Al-Bilabari, Al-Tabari. But you must always bear in mind with these works that they really were written in the 9th century under an Abbasid regime which was hostile to the Umayyads, but they did refer to earlier texts which we no longer have. And that is the basis on which we create our picture, on a literary basis, of the early Islamic period. I'd like to suggest, and this is very speculative, that the information which we have from texts about the Prophet's campaigns towards the north from Medina, heading up Medina off map, once again the unsatisfactory map, but I can hardly complain because I was given a map after all. Heading up northwards from Medina.
I'd like to suggest that the campaigns the Prophet undertook towards the north have a bearing on the subsequent early Islamic, I mean by this Umayyad, interest in the area of the desert region east of Amman out towards the what is customarily called the desert passes.
And I think that the, I would like to suggest this evening that the view of the Prophet had of the region to north of Medina into southern and desert Jordan was something which the Umayyads in the long run took up and developed. I'd also like to suggest that the campaigns of the Prophet are something which can contribute very much to an understanding of this region in the later Byzantine period. And Tom Parker has worked on this, Alistair Killick has worked on this, Bert de Vries has worked on this. The fact that the Prophet was able to bring his troops into the area without any great resistance has a great bearing on what we understand of the Limes in the late Byzantine period. The Prophet's military and political attention towards the north, like the area north of the Hejaz, manifests itself as really in two major directional thrusts. One, up from Medina directly northwards, following the railway line, up towards Ma'an, up towards, but not reaching Kerak. And also, in the general direction of Palestine. I'll come back to this point later, Palestine. The second major directional thrust is up towards Dunes de Jandal at the southern end of the Wadi Sirhan, i.e. about here, bringing you up to the area of Azra, because the Wadi Sirhan is a major and very ancient passageway out of Central Arabia into the Azra region. And the Prophet's campaigns obviously reflect an appreciation of the significance of both routes. As far as the western route goes, the route from Medina up to, through the modern railway line, or the late Ottoman railway line, is concerned, we see the campaigns heading towards Khaybar in Saudi Arabia, towards Fanak, both Jewish communities, and then also to the area around Medina Saleh in Saudi Arabia, north of Medina again, along the same line, known in the text as Wadi al-Qura, and finally culminating in the campaigns of the Prophet at Tabuk and at Mutta. Tabuk being here, just south of the Saudi border, and Mutta being about 10 kilometres, 15 kilometres south. In the period of the Prophet, it was quite clear that the northern campaigns were a major preoccupation. We know, of course, that he sent out expeditions to other parts of Arabia, to Yemen, to Oman, to Bahrain, towards Bahrain, and to Najd. But the recurrent interest in the north, I think, is a striking factor in understanding the Prophet's thinking in a military and political sense. The corroboration of this lies perhaps in the fact that in about 626, among a series of letters that the Prophet sent to various significant leaders of the period, the bishop, or the patriarch of Alexandria, the emperor of Byzantium, the Sasanian emperor, and for this area most specifically, most interestingly, the ruler of Bosra. The letters which were sent by the Prophet to persuade these individuals to convert to Islam or accept taxation by the Islamic State in Medina. The very fact that the letter was sent to Bosra suggests to me that that was considered to be a major area of interest for the Prophet. Secondly, we do have in the Quran a reference that indicates his concern with the north. In the Surah Ar-Rum, where it is said, the Greeks have been vanquished in the nearer part of the land, and after their vanquishing, they shall be victors in a few years. Now this reference in the Quran, whatever religious interpretation lies in it, in the historical sense, indicates the concern
I reckon that indicates the dates of Sura itself, but also shows the impact as far south as Medina of the Sasanian conquests on the region. The Sasanian conquests that took Jerusalem in 614, took Alexandria in 616, 617, and reflects the broader political concerns of the Muslim state in Medina. And I think this point must be taken with the point I made about Bosra, the point I made about Wadi Sir Han, the campaigns of the Prophet, that there was a very strong consciousness of the northern significance of the north and a general northern drift within the overall framework of the Prophet's campaigns within Arabia.
If I can have this, the first sentence. I'm sorry, I'm going to switch slides on and off. This is Azraq up here, the Wadi Sir Han. What I really want to show is not on the map, towards the Jandals and south. No, I'm played by that, I'm sorry. But this area of the East Media is all of you. Azraq working towards the west, Qusr Amra is that particular dot, out to Harana, Hasmashesh, Suwaka, etc. Mishan. This area figured in the earliest campaigns of the Prophet. If I may enumerate the campaigns, which I think is of significance in the framework I'm trying to build up, in 626, in August, according to the texts, although there's some doubt about whether it was actually August, the Prophet himself made an expedition from Medina to the vicinity, not actually to the town, but to the vicinity of Dumas of Jandal, Jandal being down here. If I can have the next slide, please. This is Dumas of Jandal in northern Saudi Arabia. It's now been, since I took this photograph in 1975, and a great deal has been demolished. This area over here is all gone. What you see is the mosque of Umar ibn Khattab, which has no direct relevance to the lecture, really a picture of Dumas of Jandal, but is of some interest. This tower is the minaret of the mosque of Umar ibn Khattab. I think that this mosque is actually really late 1790s Wahhabi mosque, but you'll notice that the orientation of the tower is totally different from Qibla wall, this of the mosque itself. And there is a local tradition, which I would not really dispute, that this tower is actually a Christian structure, i.e. built belonging to a church. The church transformed into a mosque in the time of Umar, i.e. between 632 and 634. But this has a bearing on what I'm about to say. The other campaigns of the Prophet in these early years before the taking of Mecca, immediately after the taking of Mecca, we have an expedition towards the Hisma area. Hisma, which is more or less straddles the Jordan-Saudi border, the Hisma Plateau, which was undertaken not by the Prophet himself, but by one of his generals in October, November 627. We have a succession of expeditions out of Medina, heading northwards again towards the region of Wadi al-Qura, the Medain Saleh area, north of Medina, which are so numerous it's not worth giving a list of them. It would be tedious to give a list. We have an expedition again dispatched to the region of Dumas al-Jandal, in January, February 628, which the Prophet didn't accompany, but it was obvious that the place had a major significance in his mind. Dumas Jandal, a musterous is again, lying at the end of the Wadi Sir Han, gives you access not only to Jordan from the back, but also towards the east, and also up into the desert areas of Syria. Then we have the most dramatic expedition ordered by the Prophet to Mutta in southern Jordan, south of Kerak, by 10-15 kilometres, which was undertaken in September 629. And I shall return to the question of this raid again. The raid, or the expedition to Mutta, ended in a harsh defeat for the Muslims at the hands of Byzantine troops and Byzantine Confederate troops. Arab tribal levies. But the result
of that expedition at Utka in 629 was the fact the Prophet felt that he ought to reassert his presence, the Muslim state's presence in the area, by a further expedition to the region of Tobruk.
Tobruk, just south of the Saudi border here.
And the Prophet undertook this expedition in 630 at a time when he had already taken Mecca, his position in Arabia was secure. The expedition took place in November, December, 630. And with his position in Mecca behind him, totally secure, his position in the whole of Arabia secure, he could turn his attention to this recurrent theme of the expeditions which have been sent out so far, i.e. the north. Having avenged the defeat at Mutta by his presence at Tobruk, he didn't head any further north, which I think was probably a very wise tactical move. He did not expose himself and his forces to further assaults by the Byzantines, who were presumably operating north of Wadi Nuri, which I think is confirmed by your Tom Parker's own work. You're looking at the signature looking at this. At this time, the Prophet having stationed himself in Tobruk, he received delegations from a number of places, and I think the distribution of those places is very important. He received delegations from Ayla, Agaba, the head of the Gulf, from Makna, and from Udruk, where Alistair Kennedy is now dealing. The delegation which the Prophet received from Ayla, which reported to its leader in person, is identified in a succession of Arabic sources as having a Christian official, whether it was a bishop or an official is not clear, but it was an official of some sort, and the texts always pick up on the back he's wearing a cross. One assumes he was probably an official. From Makna, there was a delegation of Jews. Makna on the Gulf of Aqaba, on the Sinai side. And then from Udra, the texts vary. Some say Christians, some say Jews. The majority say say Christians. But Christians, as far north of Udra as Udra, about here, towards Ma'an, felt it worth their while to send delegates to offer their allegiance. Not to convert to Islam, to offer their allegiance, pay taxes to the Prophet. I think this is very, very important because it implies that Byzantine control in southern Jordan at this period was very, very lax. It was virtually non-existent. But the Prophet, even as far south as Tobruk, there was no Byzantine control sufficient to dissuade a Byzantine official like the bishop or whatever he was, Aqaba, Ayla, dissuaded from going down to the book to offer his allegiance. All intents and purposes, Byzantine control in southern Jordan was no longer present. So we have a situation in which the Prophet at Tobruk, the Byzantine Empire collapsing rapidly in the north. One must look at the state of the Byzantine presence in the region. After the siege and capture of Jerusalem in 614, the Sasanians, and then the subsequent complete, or assumes complete, collapse of authority of not only the Byzantines themselves in Palestine, Syria, and Jordan, but the collapse of the authority of their allies, people like Bani Hassan, Jadam, the Christian tribes who have been allied to the Byzantine state in the area during the course of the 6th century. The complete collapse of this Byzantine authority, we find that a power vacuum is created. We don't really know much, quite honestly, about what the Sasanian presence in this region really meant. The Sasanians, having taken Jerusalem in 614,
taking Alexandria in 616, 617, were present in the area up until 629. But what that actually meant on the ground, I don't think anyone is prepared to really risk their necks on by expressing their opinion. I certainly am not. But I think one thing which we might all agree on is that the structure of power in the area was transformed by this Sasanian presence, simply because those people who customarily relied upon the Byzantines for their support and that support was drawn with the Byzantine defeat. The Byzantines, under the Emperor Heraclius, brought the Sasanian state to its knees by 629, by a series of campaigns headed, directed out of Armenia down into Upper Iraq. The fighting really didn't take place in this area at all. But with the collapse of the Sasanian state, the Byzantines, Heraclius leading the way, were able to return into this area of Jordan and Egypt. And in 630, Heraclius himself brought back the cross, the true cross, whatever was interpreted as being the true cross, which had been taken from Jerusalem by the Sasanians back into northwestern Iran. He brought the true cross back to Jerusalem, and this was a great statement of Byzantine reassertion of authority. However, despite the fact in Jerusalem and towns to the north, Byzantine control had been reasserted, it's quite clear from what I've said before, the fact that the Prophet comes to Tabuk and everyone would submit to him, the Byzantine control in southern Jordan had not been reasserted. Southern Jordan remained an area of no great control. And I would suggest that what we're seeing is the in this vacuum created with the withdrawal of Sasanian power, the failure totally to re-establish Byzantine power, the local tribes in the area, Khorasan, Chadan, and the Muslim state in the south, were all attempting to assert their power in the region. And that region meant southern Jordan, as well as the northern Hejaz. The fact that in 630, when the Prophet had taken Tabuk, he was able to send a further expedition under Khalid ibn al-Walid out to the northeast of Tabuk, out to Dimut al-Jandal, I hear, out to there. The fact that he was able to send that expedition headed by Khalid ibn al-Walid, who eventually was to take Damascus, and that Khalid was able to seize the ruling prince of Dumut, proclaim him, and take him back to Medina, underlines, I think, the fact that the Byzantine power, at the southern end of the Wadi Sirhan, did not exist anymore as well. So they had lost control of southern Jordan, and I would argue they had lost control of the southern end of the Wadi Sirhan. Before the Prophet troops took Al-Qaeda from Dumut al-Jandal, it is fairly clear, by implication, if not direct statement in the texts, that Dumut al-Jandal and the southern end of the Wadi Sirhan had been an area in treaty alliance with the Byzantines. It was not a part of the Libes, it was not a part of the Byzantine defense system, it was merely an area in which there was a treaty with the noble Arab rulers. This is clear enough from the Arabic texts because we have this reference to the fact that the prince of Dumut al-Jandal, Akkadia, was wearing a cross when he was captured. There are other indications indicating that there was a connection with Byzantium. And yet, the Byzantines were not able to exercise any power to support him in this 630 expedition. Byzantine power collapsed. And I think, again, survey work, especially Tom Barnes' work, taking place here, underlined the fact that the late Byzantine period, we don't really have much Byzantine presence. I think you would agree, south of the Wadi Qumran. The successes in the time of the Prophet, heading towards the north, seizing power in Dhu'at al-Jandal, establishing this strong presence in the area around the book, the north of the book, led to further expansionist aims. And at the time of the death of the Prophet in 632, an expedition had already been planned into Palestine. The term Philistine is used in the texts. What they meant by Philistine is not entirely clear to me, whether they meant one of the Byzantine provincial divisions of Palestine, but I mean, which of course has an effect insofar as if you say Palestine, it could be anywhere from Gaza across to the desert region. But an expedition was planned, it was just before the Prophet died in Palestine, led by Osama ibn Zayd ibn Haritha. His father had in fact been killed at the Battle of Mu'tah. He had been sent to revenge the defeat by Mu'tah. The expedition was planned before the Prophet died, and after the Prophet died, the expedition continued. Can it continue this northern drift? And this expedition, I think, was based upon the fact that they had success in their former expeditions in this general direction. And this disintegration of Byzantine authority. Having said so much of the successes of the Muslim state in the south and the disintegration of the Byzantines, I'd like to say something about the character of the Byzantine presence in southern Jordan, central Jordan, southern Jordan in this period, according to the Arabic sources. It would seem that at the time, in the late 620s, 628, 629, 630, the presence of the Byzantines was effective in the region by a Ghassanid emir at Bosra. Bosra in Syria, just across the border from the Haran. The troops used by the Byzantines were Ghassanid. They were also raised from other Christian tribes. The Ghassanids, of course, were Christian, but also raised from other Christian tribes, the Jilzan, Amila, and other lesser tribes. And we know that a Jilzami emir was in control of Ma'an. The Jilzan, Ghassan, and these other minor Christian tribes supported the Byzantines, maintained their support for the Byzantines right the way up until 636, the time of the Battle of Yarmouk. With the collapse of the Byzantine resistance to the Muslim attack, then of course the confederate tribes' support for the Byzantines, the basis for the reasons, mathematically their support, were ripped from under them, and the whole resistance locally, as well as the Byzantine resistance, all collapsed. But in fact, while one is given the impression from the texts that there was a sustained Hassan, the Jadam, and other tribal support for the Byzantines right the way up to the Yarmouk battle in 636, things were not quite so straightforward. There is evidence from the texts of splintering among the tribes. Elements of Jadam broke away and gave allegiance to the Prophet long before the whole collapse in 636. We find other tribal groups doing the same. Nor, for that matter, was the power of the Ghassan as secure by the late 620s as it had been in the latter part of the 6th century. The psychological effect of the Sassanian conquest, which had destroyed Byzantine power in the area between 614 and 628, also had the effect of undermining their confederates' power in the region. And so, with the return of the Byzantines, the Ghassan were presented with a situation where they had to re-establish their power in their various centres, having lost the effect that their connection with Byzantium had given them in the course of the 6th century. They were now fighting back, and I think one can see that other tribal groups, be it Jordan, be it other tribes, or be it the Muslim state in Medina, perceived that in this period of Byzantine weakness, as they tried to reassert control, as the Ghassan tried to reassert control,
Basically, the whole area is open to anyone who can make the capacity to bring in troops and seize it themselves. And I think one sees with the presence of the Assad in the area of Basra, Shaddam in Ma'an, they had control in those towns, but outside that, they had no great degree of control. And I think this is, to come back to my original point, very much emphasized by this expedition of the Prophet to Tabuk. If the Byzantines or their allies had had power, then I cannot see any reason why the Byzantine official in Aqaba or the officials in Uzur or Makna would have submitted the Prophet in Tabuk. The area was open to anyone who had the capacity to take power. This then is the political and military background to the situation. I'd like to now bring some archaeological material to bear on this framework. I would like to suggest, and this is very hypothetical, the eventual Umayyad development of the desert region of Jordan, heading out east of Amman. Amman, let's get off map. Over here. Heading out eastwards from Amman to Azraq, at the head of the Wadi Sirhan, the well-known passes Qastal, Mishatta, Muwaqqa, Mishesh, Harada, Amra. This line of Umayyad passes, heading out into the desert to the head of the Wadi Sirhan, the area of Azraq. I would like to suggest that the ultimate development by the Umayyads of this region, the straight line west through to east, was something which was not out of the cognizance of the Prophet at the time that he planned his campaigns towards the north. His sustained attack on the north of the southern part of the Byzantine Empire, I would suggest, was an attempt by the Prophet to take the area of the Belkha, the area east of Amman, familiar to the time of the Prophet, and even perhaps beyond. The Belkha, the area north of Wadi Mujib, east of Amman, is referred to in the Arabic text in Ibn Hisham Waqili as being the gathering ground of the troops of the Byzantine Confederate troops, the Arab Christian tribal levies. In those battles that took place in the town of Mutta, at the time of the Prophet's expedition to Tabuk. It was in this area of the Belkha that troops were gathered, not only Byzantine, but I stress Arab tribal levies. In short, it was an area significant and able to sustain groups of troops when raised, troops and horses, and presumably camels. And certainly, the area of the Belkha was familiar to all living in the area, whether living in Jordan or people living in the Hejaz. It is referred to with great familiarity in the Arabic texts, as if everyone knew what the Belkha meant. The most interesting aspect of the Belkha region has been raised by the 1976 Saudi Arabian archaeological expedition headed by Dr. Robert Adam, Peter Carr and colleagues. They were speaking of a certain number of buildings at the very head of the Wadi Sirhan, here Pithra and a building at Dawkara. They questioned the usual interpretation of those buildings. Usually those buildings in Dawkara and Pithra have been assigned to Nabatean period. They very hypothetically, very tentatively, hazarded the idea that they might in fact be Ghassani buildings of immediately pre-Islamic period. It is a guess and no more, but I think it's a very interesting one. Ghassani territory encompassed, as we know, Astal, according to Isfahani,
And the water resources or the capacity for water gathering in the area is something which the Ghassan Bukhari had neglected. Ghassanid occupation in Balad al-Sham is far more familiar, of course, from places like Rusafa, up on the Euphrates, and at the site of Qasr al-Gharbi, the Qasr al-Hisham, early 8th century, but which was in fact the Ghassanid foundation. The Ghassanids are far more familiar in Syria, but they most certainly were in the south. Where then was their presence in the south? There's a possibility, as I said, they were at Pastal. This very interesting possibility, they were also at the head of the Wadi Sirhan. There's other evidence that they were actually in northern Hijaz, but this has not been much pursued. Given the capacity of the Balqa area, the area east of Amman, for marginal farming, for gathering water, for catching the runoff in the wet seasons, it seems most unlikely to me that a tribal group of Hassan, semi-settled, semi-urban, would neglect such a rich area. What I would like to argue is that being the mustering place of the troops, the Arab Confederate troops of Hassan, Jadam, of the Byzantines, the immediate pre-Islamic conquest period, it was an area which is well known to the Arabs in the south, the Arabs in the Hijaz, and the Arabs in this region as well. And being a well-known area, being a well-known rich area, it is the most likely area of interest for conquest, for incorporation into the Islamic State by the Prophet. I would like to argue that the Prophet regarded this Balqa area, which was so much affected, it was so much objective of the Mutah expedition, the Dumas al-Jandal expeditions, the Tobruk expeditions, that ultimately he would like to have taken the Balqa region into the compass of the Islamic State. And I think, since he was so clearly, in my view, which may be disputed, since he was so clearly an objective of the Prophet to take this area by a sustained attempt to take it by a pincer movement from the Wadi Sirhan this way, or a frontal attack towards Wadi Muji, I cannot see any reason why the area should lose its interest to the Muslims after the conquest. And we do see this extremely dense, considering it's a desert region, there's an extremely dense development of the desert area between, let us say, Rashata Pastal and the area of Azra and the Umayyads, reflecting this Arab appreciation of the value of the region. The distinction in the Umayyad period, of course, with whatever speculatively went on before, is that under the Umayyads we have a lavish, expensive campaign of building. Look at the next slide. All of this, I think, is familiar to everyone in this room. This is Mashata. But the interesting point about this slide, Mashata, late Umayyad, as 640s, apparently. But the interesting point about this slide, I took this in 1972 in the spring, and it does underline just how fertile that desert region is at the right time of the year. And all of us, I think, have seen the consequences of the Wadi floods when we go there in the summer. But this is what it actually means in the spring, and hence this Umayyad, I would argue earlier, concern of the region. Next slide, please. Mashata again, facade. Pastor Mashesh, with Jim Dean looking for shirts, possibly prints. One of the birkas at Pastor Mashesh, but underlying again the use of the area, presumably the Umayyad region. Dr. Razi Beach was excavated there, and seems to agree on the whole that it is basically a Umayyad occupation. But the main thing about Qasr Mashesh, to the east of Mashata and Maqba, is that it is primarily a water catchment area. Next slide, please. As you will see from the succession of slides, this is yet another Birka of Mashesh, the largest birka, 18 by 19 metres. Next slide, please. And a much smaller water tank, also a Mashesh.
And what I had thought was a dam at the Shesh, and I proved quite wrong by the beach's excavation, turns out to be a large beer bit. Then heading further to the east to Harana, you have a sustained line, I stress again, from the Shatter through to Azraq, and finally, before Azraq itself, the next slide please, Amra, where of course there is also a Pasa as well as the Bath itself. We'd like to propose that what we see with the Umayyads is a development of this region with the resources of a great empire behind them. The resources of the great empire could build a succession of rich buildings in an area long familiar to the pre-Islamic Arabs and used by the pre-Islamic Arabs. And I would suggest, or I would hypothesize, that the Umayyads were building on a greater scale the occupation which, on a lesser scale, Bani Hassan or other Arab tribes have been doing in the immediately pre-Islamic period. The scale of the Umayyad presence would affect, one assumes, also Wadisir Harm. Unfortunately, we do not know much about Wadisir Harm because very little survey had been done there, but no stress on the Islamic period. I would suggest that also this great Umayyad expansion of occupation, which I'm suggesting in Jordan, would hold true in northern Syria as well, i.e. at Qasr al-Rabi, where we have a Rasalid site, expanded greatly under Hisham with the provision of water resources, water aqueducts, etc. And also, again under Hisham, the expansion of the site of Rasafa, which had been a major Rasalid Christian settlement. I would argue what we see in Syria was happening also in Jordan. In short, the Umayyad development and building was a far more grandiose utilization of the region, already quite extensively used by the Hassan and other Christian Arab tribes before Islam. The Umayyads who used the desert area would have known, and certainly their fathers would have known, very intimately, the Masalid and Jadam and other Christian Arab tribes' use of this eastern area of Jordan. I suggest that when the Umayyads started to develop the eastern desert area, they were not creating an innovation by any means, except in terms of scale. Rather, they were continuing in a coherent and systematic way with this building of sites like Mashash, like Mashata, like Amr, they were trying to expand upon a presence which was already familiar and a known quantity to pre-Islamic Arabs. They were working within a tradition of their own. And that the Prophet, I return to this point again, the Prophet, when he turned his attention to the north, was reflecting himself the appreciation of the Arabs in Medina, in the Hijaz, of the value, the traditionally known value, of this particular region to the north. The very fact that we can have sustained campaigns to Mutta, to Tabuk, to Wadi Sirhan controlling the southeastern access to the region, and also the fact we have this attempt to convert the Rasalid ruler of Bosra in 626, the area was something of major significance to them. And I think the understanding of how significant the area to the north of the Hijaz was to the Prophet is underlined by the degree to which the Umayyads so subsequently developed it. It was something which they knew, as I said before, their fathers, their grandfathers had known as well in the time of the Prophet. So I think what you're getting in the eastern desert of Jordan is merely the consequence of an Arab regime in the south, in the Hijaz, the Umayyads, putting in a great deal of money into an area which had long been valued and utilized by. It's totally speculative, perhaps, that I
look forward to your disputations on the point. Thank you.
I think Jeffrey would be happy to answer questions for a few minutes. Won't you?
It's disputations, I'm waiting for.
Well, I find that since a lot of conclusions are based on my work, I find it hard to disagree with there are one or two points though, that I would like to make. On the Byzantine client forces, the Federate Arab forces that were in the area, you make the point that the Persian invasion and the Sassanid occupation of these eastern provinces really undermined their position in the area, and I think that's certainly true. However, the Byzantine emperors, when they reoccupied the areas, made a fatal mistake, in addition, and that is that they apparently terminated their annual subsidy payments to some of these tribes just prior to the Muslim invasion. And I think that was also, a factor. You mentioned that even before the Yarmouk, some of the tribes had begun to, swing away from the empire and towards the Muslim forces. And I think the termination of subsidies to some of the tribes may have well figured in that. The other point that I'd like to raise is that you've thoroughly surveyed these, Umayyad so-called desert palaces now. Over the last few years, have you found much concrete evidence of late Byzantine occupation at many of these sites?
This is a question before I even reveal. Does Saddam, for instance, the publication still related? Iran, the publication still related? Meshesh is currently brought up. Meshata has been brought up so many times. We have much shared, but of course, Meshata is a very different case because of so many. I'm saying it's speculative. But one assumes, if one finds late Byzantine possibly the greater, then we might also wonder who were the late Byzantines, but how many Byzantines really were there in this area? So there might have been a few actual Greek-speaking Greeks in the Raza. Who were the rest of them?
I would admit that these are probably Sassanid or Arab. The evidence seems clear at Halabat, for example. We have clear late Byzantine evidence there. But I'm wondering, as we move further east towards the Azraq Oasis, if we have late Byzantine evidence further.
But the question which is interesting in that one is that what does it actually mean when you have these other tribes who are known to be Christian, like Benekel or Dari, some times related to Christianity in the period? What does it actually mean when you get deep into the desert? The Lebanon conversion is known to be somewhat eccentric at times. How much cultural impact did it have as well? Were they using, for instance, Byzantine pottery when they hadn't converted? It's a very unknown area. As I stressed earlier, it was a very speculative point. But with Hassan, I would imagine, and even with Jadal, that you might expect a greater Byzantine cultural penetration, which in terms of material penetration, one assumes might be important.
One other point that I think is in the support of your thesis is that the Alime survey in the 70s showed that one area that the Byzantines did not abandon in terms of their fortification system was the northwestern outlet of the Wadi Sirhan. So they apparently were quite aware of their vulnerability in this area. The forts there do show occupation right through the late Byzantine period, which I think supports your thesis.
Which, in fact, to that point, the very fact that the alliance with Al-Qaeda, maintained itself right up until the time Khalid ibn Walid presented himself on the doorstep, would suggest, at which point the Byzantines would also support your thesis, that the Byzantine interest, if not actual power, extended right away to the south end of this year. No attempts?
Thank you very much.